Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Congressman Jim McDermott on the line with us from Washington State, one of the folks who back before we initially invaded Iraq had gone over there, looked over the situation, and said, come back and said, don't think so. Don't think it's such a good plan. Congressman McDermott, you're back again from a trip to the Middle East. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be back.
Great to have you here back with us on the program and back here in the United States. You put together, in fact, I mean, you're doing it right this time. You put together a slideshow for Congress?
Yeah, I actually went over for 3 days right after the election. I left on Wednesday after Tuesday election. Spent 3 days and interviewed about 30 different people, Iraqis from all Kurds, Shia, Sunni, parliamentarians from Jordan, people from the Palestinian area. I really tried to get a broad reach of thinking about what was going on in Iraq and what might possibly be done to get us out of it, and then came home and distilled that down into a video.
What's this in summary and then in detail? What did you learn?
Well, I really came away with the feeling that people are looking for some kind of plan to get us out of there. And Mr. Bush continues. I mean, people ought to listen very carefully tonight. I think he's just going to say more of the same. But that's not going to work. Everyone I talked to said there are really three or four things that really ought to be done fairly quickly. One of them is to simply stop sending more troops. I got a call the other day from one of my friends in Amman who said, I'm really frightened about this new bunch he's sending into Baghdad, and he thinks he's going to embed them with the Iraqi militias. They don't know who to trust. Mm-hmm. They don't speak the language. They're going to be killed by the guy standing at their own elbow not careful.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, or if I'm getting this wrong. The Mehdi Army, for example, Sadr, has, at least according to some sources, given literally divisions to the Iraqi army. In other words, they're Shia, their first loyalty is to Sadr and the Mehdi army, but they're wearing the uniforms of the Iraqi army. And if U.S. soldiers were embedded with a group like that, and they were put into a Sunni neighborhood, for example, to keep the peace, they would find themselves in the middle of a civil war at that particular point in place, right?
And may well find themselves part of what is becoming ethnic cleansing in Baghdad. I mean, the old interspersing of Sunni and Shia without recognition of what your church or what your sect was is over. They're driving Shia out of one part and driving Sunni out of another, and our troops are going to be right in the middle of that. And are essentially going to be a part of the operation that these militiamen are up to. I think it's a terrible, terrible decision.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that they said, almost every Iraqi said, you know, one thing you could do, because Bremer made a couple of serious mistakes, one of which was opening the borders. They said, move your troops out to the Iranian border and out to the Syrian border and let them be border guards. When Saddam Hussein was there, they had 25 checkpoints between Iraq and Iran. Today there are two.
Hmm.
And they said the people who were coming in from Iran, bringing money, weapons, whatever, or soldier, you know, militiamen, are simply aiding and abetting the turmoil that's going on in Baghdad. And if you had your troops out there as border guards, much like people recommend, you know, we put our National Guard down on the Rio Grande. Mm-hmm. Well, put them over on the Iranian border and stop them from coming in. Then we can solve this problem among ourselves, among Iraqis.
Now, if that was a call you got from Oman, in all probability it was a Sunni saying that to you, and why did they not also recommend that you close the border between Iraq and Saudi Arabia? Because the Saudis have said that if they feel that the Sunnis are threatened in Iraq, that they're gonna cross that border and they're going to go to the defense of their brethren.
Well, that's that's the problem, that this thing is escalating. And although the people who I talked to didn't talk about it, although I did talk to Shia, because there are a lot of Shia who are secular and don't fall into the cleric-led, Iranian-led Shia. You really have to make a distinction between, in fact, most Iraqis will say you're either talking about Arabs or Persians or Iraqis or Iranians. They see the Shias as being controlled from Tehran. And although, and of course, Muqtada al-Sadr, he's a problem for him because he's an Iraqi who is at the moment helping the Shia, but they think that ultimately he will get back to his nationalist roots. Now, that's the confusing part of it all. It is not a simple yes or no. One of the things they said, if you want to have an army, you ought to contact the former generals, and the generals were both Shia and Sunni, who were good soldiers, but not criminals, obviously, and let them call back their units who were out there. When Bremer disbanded the army, in one fell swoop, he put 500,000 people, men, on the street with a gun and a grudge, and no way to support their family. Many of them are involved in this warfare that's going on now. But they could be brought back into an army and be a real Iraq army that the people would respect, and that the insurgents, they said the Al-Qaeda will be gone in an afternoon if you get the Iraq army back.
Right. Now, all this demathification that was part of was something that was recommended by Ahmad Chalabi. And Chalabi is now positioned to perhaps even be the new prime minister of Iraq, I'm hearing.
Well, that's one of the reasons I entitled my video, Listening to Mideast Voices. One of the things they said was, you listen to the wrong people over and over again. You listen to the guy in the silk suit who's living in London.
Right.
And been to a university and speaks your kind of language, and you think that you're getting a straight story, but you haven't talked to us who have stayed here on the ground and lived. Some been thrown in prison, gotten out of prison. They said you simply are getting bad advice, and the idea of debathification, what you did was you wiped out the whole they call it the technocratic government of the civil service. Right. School teachers were in the Ba'ath Party. Now, you know, if you wanted a job in those days in Iraq, you had to belong to the Ba'ath Party.
Right. So what they did was they got rid of the white collar class, we might say.
Exactly.
And even the high end of the blue collar class, the engineers, the shop foreman, all that kind of thing.
Yep. They got rid of everybody who knew how to run the sewer system and run the electrical system and run the oil company. I mean, all of this was a decision that they see as being handing Iraq to the Iranians, handing it to the Shia.
Yeah.
And they said it started when he put the council together, Bremer. He had 13 Shia on it and 12 Sunni and others. And they said that was the sign to everybody in Iraq that the decision had been made in Washington to give it to the Iranians.
Right. Now, why would Washington, D.C., why would Paul Bremer and George Bush decide to give Iraq to the Iranians?
Well, there are lots and lots of conjecture about that, about whether they felt that. I mean, some people say there was a theory around that if you had chaos, you would somehow, out of this creative chaos, something new would be born, sort of burn the house down, and out of the embers will rise this new place. Others said it's because they didn't really understand what they were doing. They thought that Chalabi was a Shiite who was trustworthy, and they followed his advice, and that led them into situations where they simply did not get good advice, and now we're paying the price for it. Their feeling was that the Americans never, ever wanted to have a strong Iraq.
Yeah. We just have a little bit of time left. Congressman Jim McDermott from Washington State, what should we do?
Well, at this point, I think the first thing is when you're in trouble, stop digging. When you're in a hole, stop digging.
Yeah.
Throwing 20,000 more troops in there is wrong. It will lead to more deaths, and it's going to lead to more chaos, and it is not going to work.
Should Congress use the power of the purse to enforce this?
I personally think we ought to, yes. But you see, the president did an end around us. He announced it at the same time he was landing people on the ground, and it's very hard to say we're going to deny money for food and medicine and body armor and whatever to people that are already over there. The real question, Tom, is this. How do we get control of this president? He is totally out of control.
Do you have an answer for that?
We're struggling with it in terms of how we do it with the budget.
Congressman McDermott, can you stick around for a minute?
Sure.
Okay, stick around. We'll talk after the break. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
I got news of the very best kind about troubles. I'm better falling behind about people that used to be blind till they open up their eyes and see. It's news when they begin to ask why they're poor until the day they deny they're tired. A pie in the sky and they want some security.
And welcome back, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Congressman Jim McDermott of Washington State, one of the earliest voices speaking out against the invasion of Iraq in the first place, now just back from the Middle East. Welcome back, Congressman.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be back.
Yeah, and I'm curious, you know, tonight, I'm curious about your take on this. Tonight, I predict that George W. Bush will do his very best to conflate this ephemeral war on terror, this construct, with the ongoing occupation of Iraq, rather than talking about Iraq, you know, in a separate package as it really properly probably should be. How do the Democrats take back or seize the initiative of discussing the context of our presence in Iraq as an occupying force and how we're being resisted by, you know, the citizens on the ground saying, hey, wait a minute, this is our country, get the heck out of here. How do the Democrats take back that conversation?
Well, I think that the only way we can do it is first of all, by passing a resolution saying that the president shouldn't send the troops in there. I think that will at least begin to flesh out where people are coming from. I think the next stage, one of the things you got to say about this president, he is impervious to anybody. The election of the last November, he blew it off like it never happened. The Iraq Study Group came out with their proposal. He blew that off like he'd never heard of them, didn't know who they were. And he just keeps charging along. So he's ultimately going to force us to pass laws to stop him from doing things. I think that the American people are way ahead of us in the Congress. And they are prepared for us to go after him. But we'll probably do it more slowly than you and I might want to do it, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready to go now, but I know many of my colleagues aren't quite there yet.
Yeah. By go, you mean passing laws to stop him from continuing to break the law and also to stop him from continuing to escalate this war. In fact, reverse the process. Let's get us out of Iraq.
Yes. I think most of us are now at the point where we think that this is not a good thing to do to go forward. And the question is, when you have a president who is acting as though he is unconstrained by anyone, it is extremely, it's scary, frankly, to watch that and to think to yourself, how do we get this guy, you know, to make sense?
One of the main questions that I kept waiting for somebody to ask Gonzalez, and let me just put this bug in your ear on this thing, is with Bush's illegal spying program, where he says, okay, we're not going to run our telephone tap things past a FISA judge. That FISA law was put into place because of the abuses of Richard Nixon, where Nixon was using the FBI and the CIA to listen in on the telephone conversations of Democrats. Nixon was, you know, busted into the Democratic headquarters at the Watergate. He had the plumbers and all that. We know that 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, that one of the staffers in Orrin Hatch's office had hacked into the computer of Ted Kennedy and several other Democrats, and for over a year was reading all of their email and passing that information along to Mr. Frist and others about the Democratic strategies to deal with judicial nominees, and that Republicans were making press pronouncements and strategy things based on evident, you know, intelligence that they were gathering from this hack. I mean, Orrin Hatch admitted this when he fired the guy. Why has nobody asked Bush or Gonzalez if they were, if the reason why they didn't want to go before a judge, and the reason why even now they're asking for blanket permission to do spying rather than case by case, is because they're using it for political intelligence?
Well, I can't answer for what's going on in the Senate, but I think that what you're seeing is trying to figure out how you put a guy, slow a guy down who is clearly acting as though there is nobody who can control him. And I think that we've never, in my lifetime, we've never had any president act like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so a democracy, you know, Winston Churchill said democracy is the worst form of government.
Other than all the others.
Yes, and then he also said you can always trust the Americans to try everything before they finally do the right thing. Well, in this instance, they are gradually coming to the conclusion that there is no way but to take this guy head on.
Yeah.
I think you're going to see a real crisis develop if the president continues his kind of reckless behavior of just doing whatever comes down the road. I mean, he just doesn't act like he's part of the rest of the country.
Yeah, well, and I sometimes think he's not. Congressman Jim McDermott, and if you can get that question asked, I would sure love to know. You know, just somebody asking the Bush administration, were you guys bugging the Democrats? I mean, is at any point? I mean, just it could be this could be the next Watergate. Congressman Jim McDermott, thanks so much for being with us.
We'll talk to you.
Indeed. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You got to fight for your rights. You can't throw your head in the sand. You got to fight for your rights. You can't just throw your head in the sand. Politics and religious superstition go.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. By the way, just a heads up, Thursday and Friday this week, the 25th and 26th of January, I'll be in Washington, D.C. doing this program live from a radio row at the Mayflower Hotel at the Families USA Conference. And on Thursday night, the 25th, open to the public, I'll be doing a book signing and giving a short talk on Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, what we can do about it. So drop by and say hi. 6 p.m. Thursday night, January 25th, Washington, D.C., the Mayflower Hotel. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Just watch tonight. Bush is going to conflate Iraq with his so-called war on terrorism as if there was such a thing. Roland in Medford, Oregon. Hey, Roland, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for everything.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a point on the Congressman McDermott talking about passing a resolution and then passing laws to tell him that he can't do these things. And it's like a kid that's run away five times and you put him on restriction. He just doesn't care.
Right.
Passing a law isn't going to accomplish anything if he feels he's above the law. He has to sign a law for it to become a law.
Well, and not only that, the executive branch is in charge of enforcing the laws.
Correct. Correct.
The legislative branch can only control what happens inside the offices and chambers of the House and Senate. They have their own police force for that. But outside of that, they have no police power.
That's correct. And I forgot the other point I was going to make.
Well, I'm sorry.
Anyway, it's just that he feels he's above the law, so it doesn't make any sense to pass a law to tell him he can't do that because he'll just ignore it.
Yeah. Yeah, good point, Roland, and well made. We'll see what happens. Gary in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hey, Gary.
I'm a truck driver. I'm coming up to Allentown Friday. I'm catching a bus and coming down to the march in Washington this weekend.
On Saturday. Well, good on you. Good on
anyway, you. I was basically going to say the same thing the previous caller did. You know, this last 10 years has been a real lesson in civics, and I learned more out here than I've ever learned in class. But I don't understand what Congress can do when the president has the ability to veto any laws that they pass, and they don't have the ability, they don't have the numbers, I don't think, to overturn a veto. It seems to me that their only answer is in the investigations and find the definite examples of where he's broken the law and impeachment process.
Yeah, I don't disagree that should be done. In fact, I'm a strong advocate of investigations, and if any of those investigations expose evidence that he has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, that he be impeached. And at the same time, Congress does have the power of the purse, and I suspect that if Congress was to enforce that, it may not look right now like there is a veto-proof majority, but I suspect that as this continues, this war continues, this disaster, this tragedy continues, that
I think they could gradually start pulling enough pressure that they could bring the whole thing to a halt.
Yeah, I think
but
so
I think
too.
I think it's going to take a long time, and I think that you've still got an out of control person in the administration that is going to be pretty hard to rein in the situation.
Yeah, well, and the thing that concerns me is that Bush is looking at March for an invasion of Iran to up the ante. You know, Mercury's retrograde from February 14th to March 11th or 12th, and I know that there's astrologers in the Bush administration, just like there were the Reagan administration. Maybe as soon as Mercury goes direct, he'll attack Iran. Who knows? I don't know, but it's a strange time, and certainly that's roughly when Scott Ritter is saying it's going to happen, too, is early March. And then how's Congress going to deal with it? Because he does have the ability, under the War Powers Act, Bush has the ability to basically wage war for 60 days before he has to go to Congress and ask for permission. And he's the guy to do it, and it's a terrible thing.
I don't think there's enough people in the military that would stand up against an illegal act.
Well, they can't. I mean, they should, like Lieutenant Watada has,
happens. They can. They have that responsibility. If it's an illegal act,
right? I agree with you, but there's no tradition for that in the American military, and it's really, I mean, it's, you know, in a way, it's insurrection. It's a very, very delicate line. It's a very fine line that a lot of people in the military are very afraid to get even close to, because a military coup is no small thing, that could as easily become the outcome as simple, disobedience. So, Gary, thanks for the call.
And he knows that, too, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know. I agree. Gary, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Vic in Cedar Creek, Texas. Hey, Vic.
Wow, I wish I had framed your last discourse there. That was excellent. You went over a lot of stuff, a lot of ground there. And I'm glad you mentioned Scott Ritter. You know, people, occasionally this Chalabi figure gets brought up, and when you mentioned him as a possible prime minister of Iraq,
that is what is in the papers over the last week. Yeah, this is a guy who was sentenced to, as I recall, it was 22 or 27 years in prison in Jordan for bank fraud. He has, of course, avoided going to Jordan, so he stayed out of jail. He was the son of the richest man in Iraq. And when Saddam Hussein came over and took over, he basically kicked the guy out. And he grew up in London from the time he was 7 or 8 years old, I think it was. 13. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're saving me a lot of hot air here. But
well,
everything you said is correct. He was sentenced for bank fraud. He barely got out of Jordan in 1992 and was sentenced to hard labor, 20 years in hard labor. But I think the main thing is that this is the cat, along with Richard Pearl, who you bring up now and then,
yep.
I guess I can see them both mirroring Saddam's fate. But these two cats were the ones that fed the endless stream of the absolute fabrication and said they had Iraqi defectors, even the CIA that were telling lies about Saddam. Not that he was a great guy, but all that CIA information turned out to be bogus, and even the CIA later on didn't want to have anything to do with him. I mean, it just shows, to elevate this guy shows the credibility of our government. It's really poor.
Yeah, yeah.
This guy's a criminal. He's a...
Chalabi, yeah.
He's an escaped criminal.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Or he's an on-the-lam criminal. Yeah,
well said. Just like Bush and Cheney, they're escaped criminals in my estimation.
Well, they have yet to be charged or convicted, but Chalabi has been charged and convicted. There's no doubt about it. Vic, good point. Thank you very much for making it and calling. Ron in San Francisco, California. Hey, Ron.
Good morning. How are you, Tom?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
I had to get out of bed with the flu to talk about this one.
Oh, my. Okay.
The Democratic Party in this last election was given a mandate by the American people. Didn't every Republican senator lose his seat that was up for re-election?
Yes, sir.
Didn't all but two of their members of the House of Representatives lose their seats, and those two seats are in dispute right now?
That's my recollection. I may be wrong.
Okay, and I think that was because they wanted them to go after this cabal that's running our country right now, get them out of there, better known as impeachment.
I agree. We've had a number of people who I think are favorable to that on the program from Bernie Sanders to Jim McDermott, and everybody acknowledges that before you can have an impeachment, you have to have an investigation. You don't hold a trial for somebody before you arrest him.
John Carney's already got a book out there on this man.
Oh, I know, but he hasn't done the legal official investigation. It needs to be started right away. I think they could do it in a couple of weeks.
Doesn't the Constitution call for any time you have a president trying to run like monarchy, he is to be impeached? Isn't that in there somewhere?
Well, it says that the president, vice president, and other officers can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. It doesn't specify what they are.
3,000-plus American dead in Iraq, plus questionable ones dead in this country, I think that's a high crime, more than a misdemeanor.
I agree with you, Ron. I absolutely do agree with you, and I really believe that Congress is, that there are members of Congress, like John Conyers, for example, who's been on this program many times, who are going to be holding the hearings necessary to nail down, to explicitly say, here's what this guy did. This is what he did. And dispute that it's a crime. He broke the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act repeatedly. The FISA law, which says if a federal officer breaks it, they go to jail for 2 years. This is a felony. He broke it repeatedly. He lied to us about Iraq. He lied us into the war. He lied repeatedly about it to the American people. He lied about the intelligence. I think we ought to go back to 9/11. He knew that was coming. He knew something was coming. He had 56 specific warnings that we know of on the public record, including one where they said Bin Laden was coming to get us, and he did nothing. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. John in Chandler, Arizona. Hey, John, got about a minute before we got to take a break. What's up?
Hey, Tom, my teacher. Hey, Tom, you know a lot of people. You got a lot of friends in the Senate and Bernie and others. Is there any way you could talk to them and try to convince them we got to impeach this criminal crook we got running this country?
I can tell you, John, a lot of them believe that. The thing is, you first have to have the investigation. And so, you can call, members of Congress and say, we would like investigations that may lead to impeachment. And that makes sense to them. But when you say, hey, impeach the president, they're like, you have not yet held the trial. You have not yet held, before you can bring somebody into court, which is what an impeachment is, you have to first have an indictment. Before you have the indictment, somebody has to conduct an investigation. The police go out to the crime scene. They pull the evidence together. They present the evidence to a judge. The judge says, yep, looks to me like a crime has been committed. And then you have the indictment. And that investigation has yet to be done. And that's what we need to be encouraging, frankly, our members of Congress to do. You can call your member of Congress at 866-220-0044, toll free, or your United States senators and say, listen, we need some serious investigations into these crimes. 45 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, talking back to the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. 1-866-440-8466. Scott in Auburn, Alabama. Hey, Scott, you want to disagree with me?
I just cannot tell you how much it angers me when people such as yourself try to rewrite the record and tell us that Bush knew about 9/11 and somehow just thought it was more fun that we would all die, that members of the National Security Council, that all the full-time government employees who do not have a political affiliation, they just all somehow collectively agreed that it was okay that we allow the United States to be bombed.
Yeah, Scott, we got a terrible telephone line here, but have you ever bothered to read Richard Clark's book?
I don't read about black helicopters either.
So Richard Clark, the counterterrorism advisor, the guy who was in charge of preventing 9/11 in the Bush administration, and he wrote a book about how George Bush was ignoring him.
There are sets of facts that, in retrospect, you can weave together.
About retrospect. George W. Bush had 56 specific warnings that we know of in the public record. In fact, I would encourage you just to read the 9/11 Commission report. I mean, it's right there. He got 56 specific warnings and ignored all of them. He appointed Dick Cheney to be a head of the counterterrorism task force when he was first appointed by the Supreme Court as president and vice president. And Dick Cheney's counterterrorism task force did not meet until September. Until September. Condi Rice was told by Sandy Berger that her peer, you know, the guy who's had the job before she did, a national security advisor, Osama bin Laden's coming to get us. He should be your number one priority. She did nothing. In January, the USS Cole had been bombed in October of the year 2000. In January of 2001, a week after George W. Bush was appointed president of the United States and sworn into office, in January, the CIA and FBI put together a joint statement to the president saying, we can now say with certainty that the USS Cole was bombed by Osama bin Laden. George W. Bush did not one thing. Not one thing. And they were told, and he was told specifically, the USS Cole was done. Now, Clinton wanted to do something. He didn't know for sure who had done it. He says, as soon as we get this information, we will act on it. It came together in the second week of January in 2001. And you want to tell me that Bush just, you know, what? When the guy from the CIA came down to Crawford, Texas to give him the information, he patted the guy in the head and said, okay, now you've covered your ass, you can go back to Washington. That was like aggressive. Come on, give me a break. 1-866-440-8466. Mike in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Mike.
Oh.
Hey, what's up?
I'm sorry, I'm in Tennessee Hill, so I might lose signal. Quick question, because I heard you on the replay and I couldn't call in. The journalist who's being subpoenaed to the Lieutenant Machado.
Yes.
To his court
Sarah Martin. Olson, I think her name is. Yes.
What authority does the UCMJ think they can? There's a military court that they can subpoena a civilian stateside. I mean, this goes to the bigger picture of the intimidation and stifling of our media. But from a legal
That's a good question. You'd have to ask a JAG officer. I know that there is a barrier of some sort, a semi-permeable barrier between the military system, as you say, the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and the civilian military system. But apparently, it's permeable at that point. I'm sorry, Mike. I don't know the answer to the question, so we'll leave it up in the air, and hopefully somebody will come on the program one of these days who does know the answer. Linda in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Linda.
Hello. I wanted to speak about Mr. McDermott's comment that we need to find some way to control the president, and I think that people need to go to their local impeachment petitioning process. Here in the Seattle area, we have over 13,000 petitions that we know of. I'm working with Eastside Fellowship of Reconciliation, and you signed my petition one day. But I want you to know that now that State Senator Eric Omeg here on the East Side has promised to sponsor our resolution to impeach.
Oh, that's great. Using Jefferson's rules?
I'm sorry?
Using Jefferson's rules?
Yes, through Jefferson's rules, impeaching through the state Senate, I mean, through the state legislature.
Right.
And I know that New Mexico will do this very soon, probably on the 23rd, within a month anyway.
And Vermont is talking about it.
And Vermont will do it. Everybody needs to go to impeachment. This is the way to encourage our Congress. When I was speaking with Jay Inslee recently, I told him at that time, this is before the elections, that we had 10,000, and he couldn't believe it. Yeah. And he said, okay, well, after the elections, we can talk, but please don't ask Darcy Berner about impeachment now. It would be too embarrassing. But now we need to talk. The people need to put their foot down. There are impeachment petitions out for George Bush, Dick Cheney, Gonzalez, and this is really the only legal way that we can give our Congress the courage and the threat.
They have to know that we are behind them. And this gets back to this thing that I keep saying. It's not about leadership. It's about the parade. That if we get a big enough parade going down the street, some politician is going to run out in front, hoist up a flag, and say, this is my parade. And that's what we have to do. And, Linda, you're the parade. God bless you. So good on you.
Thank you. Well, tell everyone they can go to the E4 Impeach website and pull down their own petitions to pass.
Okay, great. What's the website? What's the website?
Yes, E4Impeach.org.
E-F-O-R-Impeach?
E-F-O-R, Eastside Fellowship of Reconciliation.
Oh, I see, okay.
Impeach.
Impeach.org. You got it. And that would be presumably in Washington State. But there's all kinds of them all over the country. And I think that we really do need to be saying this and getting the meme out. And you're not going to find politicians who are going to say, yes, I can impeach, because, again, there hasn't been, the crimes haven't been identified. We have to have the investigations as well. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And who is normal and who is not, and what is and what isn't? Jack Thomas is with us. His website, non-normie.com. Jack, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
You describe non-normies. First of all, you referenced the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of current iterations, version 4 of the American Psychiatric Association. And I always found it interesting that in the DSM, there is no, the word normal doesn't exist in there.
That's true. In fact, they have very little reference to what I deal with mostly, and that is submerged anger, which causes most of the emotional problems that we deal with today in society.
Yeah. Now, the DSM, of course, is the book that psychiatrists use and psychologists use to diagnose psychiatric illnesses. One of the things you talk over on your website about, non-normies always approach causes in extremes, two major subcategories of the non-normie causaholics, the basically we're going to shove it down your throat leader types and the we're going to follow you types. And, you know, it's some of your framing I find really interesting, but what I find particularly interesting is that it seems to me that what you're describing here repeatedly throughout this website in fairly coherent terms is George W. Bush, and yet all of the non-normies that you identify seem to be liberals.
Well, no, that's not really true. I spend a lot of time on polar right, too. You know, like, for example, a good classic example in the news today is your Reverend Phelps, you know, out of Topeka, Kansas, you know, that goes out and pickets the grave sites of military personnel.
Oh, he's not just non-normie. He's nuts.
Well, yeah, but he is what we call non-normie in the extreme polar right. You see, there's neither one of the two polars has a consensus of all non-normism. See, it's in degrees, Tom, and so as a result.
Right, but I mean, you go after, for example, the ACLU. I mean, I don't get it. The ACLU is about defending the Constitution of the United States. Isn't that kind of mainstream?
Well, yeah, you know, except for one little thing, and that is we're getting more and more non-normies into the ACLU. You know, at one time back in the
Like Bob Barr?
Yeah. Back in the early 1940s, for example, you know, the ACLU did a really major shift. You know, they purged all the communists out of their organization, and they took positions relative to foreign terrorism and people that were here, you know, that were trying to upset our government. And they took a position really that was very normal. And what's happened is that over the years they've gotten more and more non-normies, most of them polar left, into the organization. And what I'm not here to trash the ACLU. What I'm trying to do is really to help them, because as they get more and more of these people into their organization, it becomes self-destructive.
What is polar left?
Well, you have two people, for example, you know, here that are really mirror images of each other. Your polar right and your polar left are the same people. They just pick different polars in which to displace the rage that's inside of them. I spent several years with the Alateen program here in Torrance, California, and I saw this developing. It comes out of dysfunctional families, and what they do is the parents model submerging their rage and storing it up for eventual retribution, and the kids copy that behavior. And what they do is when they get to be teens, they have to do something with that rage. It's overflowing. They're in agony.
So here we have George W. Bush. As a kid, his sister died when he was 7, and his parents went to the funeral and then never discussed. They went golfing that afternoon.
And he eventually became an alcoholic, right?
Yeah, he started blowing up frogs and killing small animals. As a teenager, he's branding his friends, in the fraternity and apparently quite pleased with sadism, and now responsible for the deaths of thousands of people. Would you say that he's a non-normie?
Well, he certainly comes from a non-normie history. Now, you know, one thing that we found out...
So what do we do about him?
Well, we're going to digress from the subject if we go just strictly George Bush. You know, because no matter which way you go, whether you go polar right or polar left, you're going to find the exact same disease.
But see, I don't find George Bush anywhere on your website. But I find all these attacks on quote, well, liberals, end quote.
I was going to explain that to you. You know, essentially what it amounts to is this. We found out that people, you know, that go to sobriety, about 80% or better of them, you know, do it through Alcoholics Anonymous, about 11% do it through some sort of religious experience, and about 9% through all of the rehab programs in existence throughout the country.
Now, those are the people who acknowledge that they go to sobriety. Actually, the studies that I've seen indicate that the majority of people who become sober do so simply on their own.
No, they don't, actually. What you're talking about is a dry drunk, and that's something that we deal with a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. A dry drunk is a person who never dealt with the cause of their problem. And that person is just as dangerous after he stops drinking as he is before he was drinking.
So you're suggesting that somebody becomes a drug addict not because the drug is addictive, but because they have a problem.
Yeah, exactly, an emotional problem. After we peel back all the layers of every single person who had an emotional problem, whether it led to addictions or it led to obsessions, it was always from ungrieved anger, but from back in the youth.
What's wrong with people simply getting addicted to an addictive drug?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What's wrong with the idea that somebody could simply get addicted to an addictive drug, whether it's nicotine or alcohol?
They don't do that unless they're trying to cover over some sort of pain within their psyche. They don't. Normal
people don't go
out and become addicted.
How do you know?
Well, because of the fact that we've tracked the history of everybody that's become addicted.
Okay, so back to
the same underlying cause.
So back to the polar left. You were explaining to me how people who are on the left are not normal.
No, I didn't say that. No, I said the polar left.
Right.
Yeah, believe me, you know, people that are slightly liberal or slightly conservative are generally within the normal range.
Well, the ACLU polar left, then.
What I'm talking about is they're starting to accumulate, just like they did back, you know, prior to the 1940s.
So what are the characteristics of this polar left?
I'm sorry, what?
What are the characteristics of this polar left?
Well, first of all, number one, they're going to be all a driven personality, emotionally driven. That means that they start out with a supposition, first of all, before they even begin to look for evidence, and then they start looking for evidence back to support it. That's what both sides do. If you're dealing with a cult religion on the right, like the Muslim terrorists, you know, they start out with a supposition at the beginning, and then they search back for evidence to support it, and that includes bombing people, right? And when you get to your polar left, they start out with the supposition that a certain thing is true, and then they look
for
evidence for it.
What's the certain thing that the left says is true?
Well, you're talking about polar left now. Let's
sure.
not just talk about left, okay, because I'm not talking about people that are just slightly liberal. Okay, they're definitely within the normal range. Okay, what we're talking about here is, for example, let's say that you take a person that believes that the entire world should be atheistic and starts out with a cause that says that there is no God and everybody should believe as I do, just like your Muslim terrorists do in reverse, that they start off with the presumption.
Why does that have anything to do with the left?
What?
Why does that have anything to do with the left? That's a religious statement, not a political statement.
Because that's where people gravitate, Tom. In other words, polar people always gravitate to one of two polars, either totally obsessively atheistic or totally obsessive religious ritual type person. People.
Right. But what does that have to do with politics? Isn't Jerry Falwell like that as well?
Well, if you want to take Jerry Falwell as a little bit far to the right, there's no question, but he's not polar.
You know, why not?
Well, because of the fact that you're forgetting that I said earlier we have degrees of non-norminess. And those degrees go from just the center, you know, where we have normality all the way up. We have a test on our website, Tom, that gives you the degree of polar non-norminess that you are. And it covers both the right and the left. And as we as a country move into either one of the polars, remember it wasn't that long ago, Tom, to where we were polar right in this country. In other words, back, remember when the Ku Klux Klan was dominating politics in this country up until the 1920s?
In parts of the country, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Many, well, actually, they
I mean,
were
I don't
strong.
Personally remember it, but yeah.
They
no.
used to march down Washington, you know, down Pennsylvania Avenue, and were hailed as leaders in this country. So now they were very strong, and then of course they fell from grace with the big sex scandal back in Ohio, and that's when we started moving back towards normalcy in this country. But unfortunately, what happens is that whichever polar they come from, whether it's right or left, they infect almost like a cancer whichever side they're on. And
wouldn't it be safe to say, Jack Thomas, that by your putting together this non-normie.com website and promoting it through conservative booking agencies and trashing liberals by and large, that you're pretty non-normal?
Yeah, well, I have been not normal right from the beginning. The only difference was that I went through the 12-step program to grieve out the anger that I had inside, and that's the reason I can talk from experience on this.
I see.
Because I was a polar personality, too. I came out of it.
And you don't think that your actions are driven by that polarity anymore?
Well, let's put it this way. I work very diligently, you know, with the 12-step program to keep that from happening. I could fall back into it quite easily, Tom, left to my own devices.
Okay, or with some provocation from me one of these days.
No.
Jack Thomas, non-normie.com, the website. Jack, thanks for being a good sport, for coming on with us today.
Hey, my pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. What should we do about George W. Bush? Yeah, the non-normie of the day.
Get up, get on, get out about and shout it. Tell them all you're dressed and on your way.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen for the sponsors on your local program. Give them a call. Let them know that you're listening. Patronize their products. Tell your friends about them. As well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. All organic, all fair trade. SacredGroundsCoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics, SmallDog.com. The Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com, and Purina One Natural Blends, 866-380-MEOW, or Higgins' favorite natural cat food. I kid you not. Yes, they are sponsored, and it's true. Occasionally you get that nice confluence. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian. Julian? No, Julian. Okay, let's go to Elisa in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Elisa.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having Jim on this morning. He's a real voice of reason and a hero up here in Washington State, as he should be, I think, all around America.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I was very pleased to be the MC for that fundraiser for him. He's still being sued by Bonner, whatever his name is, for releasing the tape of Newt Gingrich breaking the law.
Oh.
And it's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and we appreciate him every day. I was thinking this morning on the ways that progressives in the country rally around things or get their information or feel more connected and in touch, and of course your program is one of the absolute highlights, and you know, other things like some of the blogs and so forth. But something that always ties me into the rest of the country is when I see or read about a poll that has shown that a majority of Americans in this country feel the way I do, be it that we support, we do not support the president escalating troops and so forth. And I'm just thinking there's somebody within the sound of our voices today out there that has some power or connections or friends in the poll business. We've got to have...
Elisa, we don't even... the ultimate poll for a member of Congress is how many phone calls they get. One phone call. I mean, if you pick up the phone and call 866-220-0044, it's toll free, 866-220-0044, and register your voice, your thoughts with your member of the House of Representatives. And if you don't know who that is, just give that Capitol Hill operator your zip code, and they will tell you who your congressman or congresswoman is and connect you. If you simply do that and say, I want investigations that could lead to impeachment, and I want you not to be afraid of impeaching because this man has committed crimes, in my opinion, that are impeachable. And that one phone call will have more impact on that member of Congress than 1,000 names on a petition or on a poll.
I agree, and I do that all the time, Tom. I'm on the phone at least once or twice a week with them. But I guess what I'm looking to get at are those people in America that might not be listening to your program but feel the way we do and might pick up a newspaper. The polls do have tremendous impact. And if Zogby or one of the larger polls did something like this, it would really wake up America, I think, in a big way. It might not filter down to Congress the next day, but it's going to get people thinking and talking about it. And when people talk about it, then it's going to become more like something that we can actually accomplish.
Yeah, I believe Zogby has done a poll on impeachment. I'm not sure that he's done a recent one. In fact, I think it was funded by opednews.com, but I'd have to go over to that website and check it out. Because basically, John Zogby will do a poll on anything if you pay him to do it.
Right, and so that's why I'm saying there's somebody out there today that has some influence or money or something that can, and of course it's got to be promoted, because if we don't hear about it, it doesn't make any difference. Yep. Maybe there hasn't been the courage to do that, but I think with this march on Washington this weekend, the 27th, and
I think a lot of things are going to change. That's the parade, and the parade is getting really big. Elisa, I've got to move along. I thank you very much for the call. Jeff in San Francisco, California. Hey, Jack.
Yeah, I just tuned into this to your program when you had Mr. Non-Normie on, and I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and psychotherapist myself. I've actually published on the subject of prescriptive eclectic treatments, that is to say, kind of looking at a wide-angle lens at all the different treatments that are out there for both mental disorders and for drug addiction and alcoholism, for that matter. And, and I have a wife who's in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very supportive of what she does. But this guy was really quoting a lot of a BS artist, in my opinion.
I wouldn't use that phrase, but I would call it nonsense. What I was struck by, and he wouldn't go there on the program the way that he does on the web and in the news releases that we get from them, is these really, really harsh attacks on quote the left, end quote. And I thought that would make an interesting conversation, but he didn't want to really describe what the characteristics. I think I asked him four times, what are the characteristics of the hard left, and didn't want to talk about it.
He's looking for some recognition there, and I guess he's kind of looking for it in some dubious places. But the thing I wanted to just point out also is that your statistic about how most people quit on their own, that is actually a fact. I mean, but the thing is, in the 12-step, there is a culture and ideology to it. It's a treatment philosophy.
No, I wasn't trashing it. I'm a supporter of AA, but the fact of the matter is that most people who quit drinking and most people who quit smoking simply quit on their own. And,
absolutely.
And that's been well validated by numerous studies over the years. And there are a lot of people who really need AA. So,
sure.
Jeff, thanks for injecting a moment of sanity into the day. I appreciate
it. No problem.
Good to hear from you. 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls after this.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're going to have to serve somebody.
And how about serving democracy? Yes. Hey, welcome back, my friends. The place for being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. George Bush tonight giving his State of the Union speech. And one of the things he's going to pitch is taxing people who have health insurance plans that cost more than $15,000 a year, and then using that money to give tax breaks to people who have cheap health insurance plans or no health insurance plans. So somebody who can hardly afford to buy food, we're going to say, you know, we're going to give you a tax break, and you can use that money to buy health insurance. Somehow I just don't think this is going to fly. This in a country where 47 million Americans are uninsured, 41% of Americans with incomes from $20,000 to $40,000 have no health insurance. The number of people without health insurance from the day Bush became was appointed president by the Supreme Court in 2001 until last year went up 16.5%. The average family of four spends over $10,800 a year on health insurance, whereas that's $10,800 a year. And if you work full-time at minimum at the current minimum wage, now, yes, it was just raised, but if you work full-time at the current minimum wage, you only make $10,700 a year, and the average family of four is $10,800 a year for health insurance. 18,000 people a year, in the United States die as a consequence of a lack of health insurance. People without health insurance are 25% more likely to die from all conditions, medical conditions, and 59% of uninsured people have with chronic conditions such as asthma or diabetes skip their medicine or go without care. We rank 37th in the world in terms of our health, the overall quality of our health care system, as ranked by the United Nations, behind Colombia and Portugal. We're 44th in the world in infant mortality. Even the top fifth of population of wage earners in the U.S., among the U.S. population, our richest one-fifth has a worse infant mortality rate than the lowest one-fifth of Canadians, because all Canadians have free health care. Of the 30 developed nations, the top 30 developed nations, the United States ranks 21st in life expectancy. We have fewer physicians, fewer doctors, fewer nurses, fewer hospital beds than most developed nations. It costs on average, our average health care cost per person, $5,600 and $5,635 per person in 2005. In Japan, on the other hand, which has a life expectancy 4.5 years longer than the United States, cost for health care per capita, $2,100, $2,139. Ours is $5,600. Theirs is $2,100. United Kingdom, $2,200. Sweden, the ultimate welfare state, $2,500. France, $2,900. Canada, $3,000. Again, ours, $5,600 per person on average. That's including everybody, even the uninsured. We have a system that is absolutely and totally broken. Why? Because 22 to 31% of all dollars spent on health care in the United States go to marketing and profits and administrative costs. On the other hand, countries that have single-payer systems, 3% overhead. Just like Medicare here in the United States, 3% overhead. Since 1970, the number of doctors in the United States has increased by 40%. Number of medical administrators, people handling money that has to do with medicine, increased by 3,000%. This is a huge, inefficient bureaucracy. This information, by the way, from healthcare-now.org, although it's all publicly available in a million places. So when you hear Bush talk about this tonight, about figuring out a way to make sure that he's just going to jerry-rig the tax code so that we can continue to give money to these health insurance companies and we continue to support a broken system, know it for what it is. For the absolute nonsense that it is. Bill in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Listen, I initially was going to call about the impeachment stuff, but this health care stuff, I mean, since I've been in high school, it's amazed me that America doesn't go for some type of national health system. I just
believe
it.
Bill, when you were a cop in Chicago, I know you're a retired police detective.
Yeah.
And you know, back in the day, you know, 20, 30 years ago, unions, 70% of Americans had either a union job or the equivalent of it.
Right,
you know,
right.
At the peak, we had 35% of all wage earners in this country were union, and every union job typically has an identical job that's a non-union job in terms of wages and benefits. So 70% of Americans had full health care You know, and you know, like my dad, you know, full Blue Cross Blue Shield right up until the day he died, paid nothing for anything.
Yeah.
And
it took us a while to get it as I was on the police department, but we finally did.
See, those days are going.
Right.
Those days are going. I mean, you got a few civil servants out there, and that's about it. And the Bushies want to do away with that.
Well, you know, and the people are going to have to watch out. They're going to pull the fear game out again like they did when Clinton tried to pass the health care system.
Yeah.
And, of course, we all heard Dole and the rest of them out there with all their alternate health system plans that as soon as the Clinton plan went under, they all disappeared. Yes. All these Republican plans disappeared.
Right. Surprise.
Yeah. And the fact is, we already have a national health care system that's worked for 45 years. It's called Medicare.
Yeah, and if we simply said everybody in the United States is eligible for Medicare, we could have a health care system in the United States that would be second to none. It would be one of the very best in the world. It would cost us roughly half of what we're paying right now, and we would just pay it in a different way. Instead of our employers writing the checks, it would come out of our taxes.
As our right-wing friends keep telling us when we want to tax corporations, well, you know, you end up paying those taxes anyway.
Yeah.
You pay it in prices. Well, we always end up paying for everything.
Well, and we're paying for it right now in lost productivity and lost, you know, it just goes on and on. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Robert in San Jose, California. It's always great to hear from you. Robert in San Jose, California. Hey, Robert. Robert? No, Robert. Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, Robert, because it sounds like you were falling over pans to get to the phone. Let's go to Lisa in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Lisa.
Hi, Tom. I was going to call you about something else, but I have to make a comment with respect to Medicare. I happen to be a physician, and I can't afford to see Medicare patients. With what they pay, which is a maximum of $67 for the type of code and the type of services that I render, I can't afford to see a patient.
And the reason for that is because there is a relative minority of Americans who are covered by Medicare. If everybody in America was covered by Medicare, then everybody in America would make sure that Medicare worked.
And plus, we wouldn't have the insurance companies making a profit off what Medicare is paying, because if you look at what Medicare pays, and if you consider the fact that the wraparound insurance policies need to generate income for the insurance companies, that leaves very little for the physician.
Yeah, plus, you know, over the last 6 years in particular, they've been privatizing pieces of Medicare.
Absolutely. And they basically wear you down when you submit a claim. They downgrade your claim without any reason, and then you have 30 days to respond. And it's a game that they play. And it's
I know. It's the same thing. I just, finally, I hadn't seen a doctor in a couple of years, thought I ought to have a physical, right? I go to do it. You know, they do all the tests and things. And I get this bill for like $60, you know, from the testing company or whatever, you know, that looks at your blood and stuff.
Right.
And I'm like, wait a minute, my health insurance company pays for this. And so I submit, well, yeah, it looks like it does, you know, but you've got to submit the bill. And then they bill me again. And it's like you said, it's just a game they're playing, hoping that I'll not open the mail that day. And then they can turn it over to a collection agency and boom, they're off to the races.
Absolutely. I'd like to get back to your question of a few minutes ago when you said, well, what do we do about George Bush? And not a very good segue, is it? But basically, I think what we need to do right now is we need to be really smart and really mature about the approach. And with respect to George Bush, we might have to just sort of make him think or let him think that we're sort of leaning back right now, because, as you know, an impeachment will take, no matter how well-intended everybody is, the investigations and everything will take a year to a year and a half, and by that time it's time for the presidential race again. But meanwhile, I think one of the goals, before you define a strategy, you need to know what your goals are. One goal that maybe we haven't talked about too much is how do we lessen the damages between now and 08? And I think that should be a very prominent goal. I think, of course, the second goal has to be to make sure that we get a Democratic president elected, not so much because
So are you suggesting, Lisa, that we follow the John Dean strategy, which, by the way, I endorse, which is start out with the middle-level guys, you know, start out with the Pearls and Fights or their equivalents, and maybe Gonzalez.
Right, Gonzalez, Alberto Gonzalez. I think he's left himself open very stupidly by claiming that there's no implicit habeas corpus in the Constitution.
Yeah, when the phrase actually exists in the Constitution.
Absolutely right. He's also broken unilaterally international agreements like the Geneva Conference.
Yeah.
He's jeopardized our security to the nth degree, and I think that if we went to Alberto Gonzalez really aggressively, I think we could get more of the Congress folks to go along with that, as opposed to the wishy-washy reaction we're getting right now with respect to impeaching Bush and everybody saying, well, we need to be polite and correct about this.
Yeah.
Alberto Gonzalez is not a polite and correct person, so we can, I think think people would feel more or freer to go after him. And I think that they would throw him under the bus eventually. But if
like they did Rumsfeld.
Yeah, I think they would throw him under, but just before the election in 08, so that Bush would still be in power. We just might have to swallow that one, but that might be the mature approach.
Well, and the main thing is to diminish their power. I mean, one of the things that Newt Gingrich was very clear about, it, the whole con thing, you know, Bob Barr, he's talked about it, that they weren't so much about getting Bill Clinton out of office as they were about diminishing his ability to get anything done.
Right, and in this case, we need to diminish the ability for this guy to damage the whole...
Further damage the United States of America and the world. I mean, you know, for that matter, these guys are raining down death and destruction on living systems from humans to, you know, right on down to offshore algae all over the world. Lisa, thank you for the call. This is, you know, well said. Yeah, let's start a movement to impeach Gonzalez. Let's start there. That actually is, I think, a very wise suggestion. 45 minutes past the hour.
A congressman from Florida sent notes to a page. Things soon got much horrider, cause the page was underage. And we're singing, hang down your head, Mark Foley, hang down your head and cry. You once appeared so holy, now the right has a big black eye.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Victoria Jones with us from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
I'm going to be at doing a radio row with you guys Thursday and Friday this week, the 25th and 26th of January, at the Mayflower Hotel, and I've gotten a couple of emails from people asking if the Radio Row part of it is going to be public, or if the only public part for me is going to be that Thursday night that we're doing the at 6 o'clock at the Mayflower Hotel, where I'm doing the book signing and talk on Screwed.
I think probably the talk is probably going to be the only part that's public. I don't think that the other part, I don't think that we've got a webcam going, in other words. I don't think we've got one, unless you're bringing one.
No, I don't have a webcam. And so the public can't come in and watch the Radio Row.
I see. I don't see why not.
Well, is it inside the conference, so they'd have to sign up for the conference?
Oh, wait a second. It probably is, isn't it?
Yeah, so my guess would be you'd have to be an attendee to the conference, and that's a couple hundred bucks. So, anyhow.
And it's worth the money to see.
Indeed. It's the Families USA Conference, by the way, and you can Google that, or I think it's familiesusa.org is their website.
I believe so.
Yeah, that's where we'll be. So, Victoria Jones, what's at the top of the news here today?
Well, I'm in the Senate and driving to my regular parking space, special press parking today. There were barriers that there aren't usually. Extra police looking severe, although once you start chatting to them, they're not severe at all. Everybody walking around with anticipation. People who normally wear regular shoes are wearing trainers, by the way, because they all know how much they're going to have to walk tonight. So you can tell that there's only one topic on everyone's mind. That is the Oscars for Washington, D.C.
Meaning the State of the Union speech.
Yeah, that is our Oscars, yes.
Yeah. And George W. Bush, originally the main message that came out was that Bush was going to talk about the surge and that he was going to try and conflate Iraq with the war on terror, thus conflating Iraq with 9/11, thus kind of implying that, we got Osama bin Laden because we hanged Saddam Hussein, et cetera, and, you know, that message for all the Foxies would get through. But now they're talking about how he's going to go heavy on domestic policy. He's going to be talking about jiggering the tax code around so that poor people can get a tax break to buy health insurance.
That seems to be the message, although my understanding is that it means that rich people will be getting a bit of a tax hike, and I don't think that'll be particularly popular either. And I think also you and I talked about this earlier, this particular health plan is so complicated, I don't think anybody understands it.
Yeah.
And I can't figure out from it whether I get a tax break or not, and I buy my own health insurance. So
yeah, well,
it's good for me.
Probably his goal is to make it as complicated as possible. I mean, it's just very simple. Victoria, let's take a couple phone calls here, if that's all right
with
you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. John in San Francisco, California. Hey, John, you're on the phone.
Well, yeah, this has to do with the normie guy. I think that some of the most outrageous extremism and genocide has been perpetrated by those that are styled the centrist and the slightly liberal and the slightly conservative. The millions killed in Vietnam were not killed by the Ku Klux Klan. They were killed by a bipartisan Democratic and Republican Party. The same, I think, with Iraq. Clinton killed over a million people with the support of the Republicans with the embargo that, according to three top aides to the Secretary General, was genocidal. You've got the Democrats now that are that voted for every appropriation for this war. The so-called centrist New York Times, Washington Post, and other media concealed all the lies that I was able to read about in some of the things called the so-called hard left, like Workers' Org and others, or 9/11 Truth.
No, John, you're singing my song. That's, you know, when somebody says that the mainstream turn and run in the other direction because they're in bed with the DLC. I mean, it's just Victoria, your response to John.
I think any response I had would be solid opinion, so I think I'll keep my own counsel.
Oh, okay, all right. Robert in San Jose, California. Robert.
Yes, I just want to talk about, you know, like you talk about investigating the president and what is the need for investigation. I want you, somebody needs to define it, because all the evidence out there has already been adjudicated to even start the impeachment of the president. He has, it's been shown that his wiretapping was illegal. It shows that he had...
It has been shown perhaps in the newspapers, but Congress has not determined that.
Well, but the courts have determined that. The courts have already said that
that's appealable all the way to the Supreme Court, and until it gets to the Supreme Court, it's not.
Yeah, you want
go ahead, Victoria.
You want paper evidence. You want solid evidence. You want T's crossed and I's dotted.
Yeah, we need an actual bill of attainder, a bill of impeachment, specifically the whole details. Jeff in Grand Isle, Vermont. Jeff.
Hey Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Listen, I just want to say, your non-normie guy you had there.
Yeah.
You know, it's a damn good thing that the founding fathers were non-normie.
We're not normal.
Or we would not be having this conversation.
There you go. Thank you very much.
Have a good one.
You too. Victoria Jones, we had a guy on at the top of the hour who was like, let's make everybody normal. And I'm like, whoa.
Whoa, don't want to go there. That sounds like lobotomy time to me.
You and I would be in big trouble.
I think so.
Emily in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Emily.
Oh, yes, Tom.
Mm-hmm. You're live with Victoria and me.
Yes. You were talking about health care. I didn't hear any mention of John Conyers' bill, H.R. 676.
Is that the one that would make Medicare available to all Americans?
Yeah, that's one way it's being referred to. It's actually called the United States National Health Insurance Act, but it's also called Medicare for All.
Yeah, I think it's a marvelous thing, Emily. And, in fact, David and I were talking a little earlier about getting John Conyers on the program. Victoria, Ted Kennedy has said he's in favor of something like that. You think it might happen?
I think we could get very close to it with this Congress. I don't think it'll happen in pure form, but I think we could get close.
That would be great. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News. Thanks, Victoria, for calling in today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. I'll see you in 2 days. 57 minutes past the hour. After the news, we're gonna have round two with the neocon of all neocons.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group Above, By, and For. We the people of the United States, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our phone number, 866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com will do it. And Dinesh D'Souza on the line, the author of The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11.
nice to be on the show.
Good to have you with us. You know, you and I talked on my national show last week, and in the intervening time period, you were on Stephen Colbert's program, and you actually said you think FDR is responsible for 9/11?
Well, no. I was responding to his humorous and ironic suggestion, because I was saying that the roots of 9/11 can be found both in the Carter and the Clinton administrations. And he said, oh, do you want to go all the way back to FDR? So I said, well, come to think of it, you know, FDR gave away half of Eastern Europe, and this emboldened the Soviets to invade Afghanistan, and that unified the Mujahideen and the Arab Afghans in fighting. So I was being ironic. I wasn't being serious about that. I was just playing his game.
But in your book, you're actually deadly serious about it. I mean, throughout this book, you use phrases like the liberal left and the liberals, and you characterize people who are actually, frankly, you know, not communists and not socialists. They're just, you know, good old trade unionists and basically Democrats of the United States, and characterize them as if they are in some way responsible for 9/11. I think this is despicable, sir.
Well, let's be clinical about it. I don't just use generalizations. I say, for example, that I think the blunders of the Carter administration, which withdrew American support for the Shah, were instrumental in installing the Khomeini regime.
How about going back to the Eisenhower administration and help put the Shah in place?
Well, maybe so.
Overthrowing Mossadegh, overthrowing a democratically elected government, and having the CIA go in and install a dictator. And now you're upset because the dictator falls?
Hold on. But Khomeini himself preached sermons when Mossadegh fell, saying how happy he was that happened, because Mossadegh was a secular socialist. So that had no relevance to the rise of radical Islam. Radical Islam got hold of a major state when Khomeini came to power. He was the first guy to call America the great state.
Right, and he came to power because we screwed up, because the CIA went in and we helped overthrow a democratically elected government. The Middle East was going on its merry way, and we're looking at all this oil and saying, hey, isn't this cool? Let's get our guy in here. Let's put Reza Pahlavi back on the throne.
First of all, Mossadegh was not democratically elected. He was not elected by the Iranian people. He suspended civil liberties. He dissolved the parliament. So he was an autocrat. This whole idea he was democratic.
But he was at least a relatively benevolent autocrat. I mean, you could argue that the current king of Jordan is an autocrat as well, or that the president of Egypt, Mubarak, is an autocrat as well. In that mold. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Shah came in as a hard right winger and started repressing his people mercilessly. Hyper-militarizing Iran, and that's
what... I agree. See, the real failure, I think, of liberal foreign policy is that in getting rid of the bad guy, you get the worst guy. I don't disagree the Shah was a bad guy, but we have to make sure we don't get something worse.
I'm not disagreeing with you that we got rid of the bad guy and we got the worst guy. My point is that the idea that has been driving all this is the one that you embrace so often and so affectionately, which is this neocon idea that the United States should be for primarily our economic interests, for the purpose of empire, for the purpose of maintaining our lifestyle here at home. We should be exploiting nations all around the world, taking their resources, installing people in their governments who are favorable to us, playing the grand chess game.
Tom, I'm just saying that foreign policy is not philanthropy. The United States does have interests in the world, and we should defend them. This is not the same thing as saying we should go out for empire. Look at Iraq. We are repeating the mistakes of Iran. It's a bad situation in Iraq. We've made a bunch of mistakes. But in trying to get rid of a bad situation, we don't want to get a worse situation. The Islamic radicals already control Iran. Do you want them now to control Iraq? Don't you think they will next target Egypt and Saudi Arabia? Wouldn't that be very bad for us?
I would submit to you, first of all, that your statement that the Islamic radicals already control Iran is not true.
Who controls Iran?
The people ultimately of Iran are going to control Iran. Yes, you do have a bunch of mullahs who theoretically and arguably, actually, in the final sense, have power over that state. But if they tried to exercise that power in a meaningful way, there'd be a revolution tomorrow, and they know it. They have a very, very limited power. They have the pomp and ceremony of power. Iran is right now electing their officials, and many of those people that they're electing are very unfavorable toward them. I mean,
they just elected Ahmadinejad, who is actually one of the most firebrands of the Islamic radicals. So
exactly, and in the most recent election, just a few weeks ago, Ahmadinejad got trashed.
Mm.
You're not disputing it. It's true.
Well,
in your book, you go on to say thus we have, this is on page 21, thus we have the first way in which the cultural left is responsible for 9/11. The left has produced a moral shift in American society, which has resulted in a deluge of gross depravity and immorality. And to that I say, nonsense, sir. It's your friends on the right who have produced this deluge of gross depravity and immorality. It's your friends on the right who are producing a culture of consumerism, who are teaching our children that buying more stuff is the way to heaven, who are promoting the idea of being that now in America you have more high school or more elementary school kids saying they want to grow up to be Bill Gates than 30, 40 years ago, before this corporate culture took hold of America, you had the average American school child saying that they wanted to grow up to be president of the United States. They wanted to be a public servant.
But Tom, what you're talking past me. I'm saying that you know, as someone who grew up, in my case, in Bombay, India, in a traditional culture, most of the cultures outside of Europe and America, the cultures of China, India, the Middle East, Africa, these are fairly traditional cultures. They are patriarchal. They tend to have the male as the head of the household. They're socially conservative. And I'm saying when the cultural left goes abroad and tries to proclaim abortion a human right or prostitution a worker's right, when Planned Parenthood distributes condoms to teenage girls in Muslim countries, this is going to produce a real blowback of cultural and moral resistance, not just from the Islamic radicals. I don't care so much about them. It's the traditional Muslims whom we have to win in this war on terror. We can't win the war if we don't drive a wedge between traditional Islam and radical Islam. So on the one hand, you're talking about some of the misplaced priorities within America, and you may be right, but I'm saying while the left is accusing Bush of foreign policy imperialism, it has its own program of cultural imperialism that it's projecting abroad, and this too is producing a blowback of Muslim rage.
You are massively, massively exaggerating and mischaracterizing U.S. foreign policy, and for that matter, even U.S. cultural policy.
I'm talking about the left's cultural activities, and the radical Muslims themselves are routinely denouncing
it. It is not the left who is Sony Pictures.
True, but what I'm saying is that's true. So you have a marriage, if you will, between left-wing social values and conservative or corporate capitalism. I don't deny that, but I'm saying that.
And it's being aggressively promoted in these countries by the economic interests on your side.
But now, if the United States, if America,
and in the midst of this, you're defending the idea that a society should burn women to death if they don't do what they're. You certainly are. You're saying that in a traditional society, the man is the head of the household, and that's how it should be.
Yeah, but that's not, don't be ridiculous. Traditional societies have existed since the beginning of time. Are you saying that traditional societies have burned women throughout history?
Actually, I would submit to you that patriarchy, the kind of what you're calling a traditional society, the patriarchal, hierarchical societies, have actually been the exception since the beginning of time. They've been the norm only in the last 3 or 4,000 years. And there's no shortage of sociology and anthropology that backs that up.
You mean since history began?
Since what you call history began.
Oh,
since okay. What we call civilization began,
right.
Yes.
Civilization things were really good, but then civilization ruined everything.
Well, if you look at the lives of Aboriginal and Indigenous people around the world, and certainly if you read the ethnographies of pre-contact Aboriginal and Indigenous people, yes. As Ben Franklin said when he stood on the floor of the in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention and introduced 34 members of the Iroquois Confederacy who were there to help us write this Constitution. He said, if five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a bond which has stood in peace for over 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can do the same.
Right.
Yes, there are a lot of pre-traditional, using your word, traditional societies, were largely egalitarian, did not participate in genocidal warfare. They used games. You know, lacrosse was a game that was used to settle disputes between tribes?
Tom, we're getting off the topic here.
No, we're not.
We're having an interesting conversation about what happened before history got started. But look, I'm talking now about the anti-Americanism in the traditional world and the Muslim world.
And you call it the traditional world. I call it the patriarchal, psychotic world.
Okay, well then.
And that's the world that you want to defend. You want to defend a world of patriarchal
liberalism. What kind of liberalism is it that looks at all the poor cultures of the world, right? The cultures of Asia, Africa, the non-Western cultures and dismisses them as psychotic. I mean, does this show any kind of respect or tolerance for other cultures? Isn't this the worst kind of Western imperialism that proclaims itself to a Rousseauistic ideal of primitivism?
If you want to suggest to me, Dinesh D'Souza, that when in India a woman is put to death because her husband has died and so she is put on top of the funeral pyre along with him, the society, the traditional society that you grew up in that you're defending, if you want to say that that's not psychotic, that's fine. You can go ahead and say it. But I defend my position that it is psychotic to put a widow, a living widow, on the funeral pyre of her husband, a practice that you know is practiced today in India, your country.
To be honest, that was one of the very good things about colonialism. Colonialism put a stop to that practice.
It is still going on.
I've written about this in my essay, Two Cheers for Colonialism. So, yeah, we have to say colonialism did do some good things. But to imply that 4 billion people in the world living in traditional cultures are all burning their lives...
In most of those cultures, slavery is the norm in as much as men own their wives. And I realize that the cultural right in this country wants us to go just like that, and I realize that that's where you're at. But I stand by my position that it's a psychotic position.
I'm just saying you have a shocking...
And I would say that is what's responsible for 9/11, not any liberal idea.
Shocking disrespect for the way people live and for their values. And
I have a shocking disrespect for people who murder their wives.
And you accuse Bush of being an imperialist. If you had power, the kind of totalitarianism that you would impose in the name of your own ideal would be actually far more repressive than anything conservatives could even conceive. Right? Because you would go into every family, right, and try to undermine the institutions, the cultures, the values.
No, I would keep us the hell out of all of them.
Okay, so then how is that helping things?
My job is not to help people in India or anywhere else in the world. My job is to help the United States of America.
Okay, so we're back to self-interest. And earlier you criticized me for saying foreign policy should protect America.
No, what you have been saying is that what is bringing down, what caused 9/11 is that we are exporting liberal values. And what I'm saying is no, what caused 9/11 is our foreign policy. And our foreign policy is...
That's what you say, sir. But what Bin Laden says is what caused 9/11 is that America is the global leader of atheism in the world. He says America is imposing its values on Muslim culture.
You know, I have actually read the collected writings of Osama bin Laden. I wrote... No, hang on just a second. I don't believe that you've actually read his collected writings.
Oh, come on. Look, I have carefully studied all his videos. There's a collection by Bruce Lawrence called The Statements of Bin Laden. It has all his statements in one place. I've read them very carefully. Are you saying that he only talks about foreign policy? He doesn't call America the leader of atheism?
Of course he does.
He does.
He's beating the drum. But you're being intellectually dishonest, Dinesh D'Souza, if you're trying to suggest that Bin Laden did not say to us, I'm going to attack you because you have American soldiers on Saudi soil defiling that soil in 1991, George Bush put them there, and because you're supporting the corrupt oligarchy of the Saudi royal family. Those were the reasons why he proposed to attack us. Then he embellished it with all this stuff about we're an evil and corrupt nation, and you know that.
The reason that he felt America is defiling Saudi soil is because he thought American soldiers would bring with them the immoral values of American culture.
Exactly, and he wanted us out of Saudi Arabia, and if we had simply left, he would have left us alone.
And should we have left?
Yes.
We should have left.
Yes.
Why? That we were invited by the Saudi government to come in and to form a coalition which was originally designed to expel Saddam Hussein, a secular dictator, by the way, whom bin Laden hated, from Kuwait. We restored the sovereignty of a small Muslim country, Kuwait. Now, what I'm saying is this was a war not against Muslims, but for Muslims. And yet, you are siding, in a way, with the bin Laden argument here, which is somehow we are defiling Saudi soil.
Who
is bin Laden to decide what the interests of the Saudis are?
You are so twisted. What I'm saying, it's
mind-boggling. That's what you just said.
I will say again what I just said. Bin Laden did not want us in Saudi Arabia. He did not want us supporting the Saudi royal family. If the principal export of Saudi Arabia was turnips, we wouldn't be there. If we had followed Jimmy Carter's policy of making this country energy independent of Saudi Arabia, we probably wouldn't have been there. George Bush Sr. wanted to have a war to protect the royal family of Kuwait. They had a PR firm down in Washington, D.C. bring in the ambassador's daughter and lie before Congress about babies being thrown out of incubators. So, you know, there is no democracy right now in Kuwait. You've replaced one. Saddam Hussein, a dictator, came in and threw out the Emir of Kuwait, a dictator, and now we've put the Emir of Kuwait, a dictator, back in there. Slavery is routinely practiced in Kuwait. You know this. This is and in order to make all this happen, we stationed American troops in Saudi Arabia in 1991, and bin Laden said, this I will not tolerate. And they've been sitting there ever since. Until last year, George W. Bush finally got the telegram from bin Laden and said, oh, gee, maybe we should do this, and he pulled our soldiers out.
Well, the reason I wrote this book, The Enemy at Home, is because I think what's going on here is there's such a pathological hatred for people like Bush, which you're showing, by the way, in your conversation.
I have not mentioned George Bush
well,
in this discussion.
Well, Bush the father.
You keep characterizing me. I haven't mentioned him.
Well, you were probably talking about the father. But look, what I'm saying is here's Kuwait. It's a traditional Muslim society, okay? It's perhaps not the best society in the world, but it's a pretty decent one compared to most of the other regimes in the Muslim world. Yet, you attack it and almost imply that the United States should not have intervened at all in its defense when it was ruthlessly invaded.
No,
even
I don't
though
think
a lot of Muslim
have.
Countries supported us, and virtually all the European countries supported us, too.
Let them deal with it themselves. This was all about oil. This was about the Bush oil family going in to protect their oil interests in Kuwait.
Their oil interests?
That's
you
right.
And I depend on oil, don't we?
That's what I'm... Our oil interests, exactly. And that's because Reagan and Bush said, no, screw this stuff, this idea that Jimmy Carter had of making America oil independent.
Well, he had an idea, but there was nothing behind that idea.
He had a very specific proposal. He actually cut our dependence on oil.
Why didn't he do anything about it?
He did. He did. And when Ronald Reagan got elected, and the first thing he did was take the solar panels off the White House and say, that's it.
Come on, look.
We're doing away with the tax breaks for alternative energy.
For the foreseeable future, we're dependent on Middle Eastern oil, and that's a fact.
Yeah, a tragic one as a result
of
people on your side of the aisle. Dinesh D'Souza, The Enemy at Home, is his book, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Dinesh, thanks for coming on and mixing it up with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Something country.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, that was a rather wild and wide-ranging conversation. We had to push the brake back, but Dinesh D'Souza, always good for a rumble. And let me take your calls and your thoughts on some of these topics. Also, the President's State of the Union address coming up tonight. He's going to become a Democrat. This is exactly what Harry Truman predicted. In fact, if I can find it, I'll share it with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Two, three, four. Ooh. 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 My heart knows it better than I know myself, so I'm gonna let it do all the talking. Ooh.
And welcome back to the vast radical liberal conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our phone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. Is it Palente? Is that how it's pronounced in Santa Fe?
Yes. Yes, it's my poet's name, Tom. I wanted to compliment you greatly on your extraordinary counter to the ridiculous, reactionary, and typically bourgeois former guest. This rationale is actually what they tell themselves.
I know.
It's part of the divide and conquer worldview that the reactionaries, or the neocons, as you call them, practiced and have practiced all through time.
Yeah, and the other thing that was really interesting is that he had no concept of human existence prior to what he calls the beginning of history or the beginning of civilization.
You know, and as a minor, one of my points, you were extraordinary because you were so powerful in your counter. You were so direct and so right on. One of the smaller points I wanted to ask you was it really the colonists who dispelled the habit of putting wives on the funeral pyre, or was it Gandhi and his colleagues who really humanized the reactionary Hindu?
That's a very good question, Palente, and I'm not really certain. I don't know that much about the history of India. What I do know is that culture, to a large extent, the leadership of a nation will help define its culture. And while political decisions can be made from the bottom up, and the election of leadership, it is a circular process. And you know, you have a warmonger in charge, people become warmongers. Look what happened in Germany during the time that Hitler was ascendant. People became crazy. Look at what happened in Japan. People became, there was a mass psychosis. I mean, people were willing to fly under the decks of American aircraft carriers and commit suicide, the kamikaze pilots. And it was from the top down. And so, which is what causes me to have, frankly, a lot of concern about the United States of America right now because of who's in charge. Russell in Queen Valley, Arizona. Hey, Russell.
Yes. How you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
I just wanted to name a couple things about George Bush. You know, when you were talking about health care, just real briefly, 1 second. We in Arizona use access to pay for the poor. The emergency room pay for the people who aren't citizens. Medicaid pays for the disabled. Medicare pays for the old. The only ones left are the healthy ones.
Yeah. And see, if everybody was tossed into the same pool and the risks were stabilized, then you'd have what actually was the philosophy behind the idea of insurance.
Yeah. Yeah, and then on George Bush, it was so classic that he has that Napoleonic complex. I mean, my God, he was 44, he left Connecticut, he's a patrician, and tried to be a cowboy. Things like bring him on, run him down and smoke him out.
I think that's actually, Russell, I don't think it's an act. I think what you see is what you get. And
I mean, that's genuinely him, but it's sick is what I mean.
Yeah, I won't disagree with that. Russell, thank you very much for the call and the point. Robert in San Jose, California. Hey, Robert. Robert? No, Robert. No, Robert. Richard in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Richard.
Oh, thank you. That conversation was stimulating.
Okay.
I can't say either of you are wrong, but I wanted to, I heard you mention the national interest of America, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but the CIA are managing the death squads in Iraq.
Well, I know that that's an allegation. I don't know. I haven't been there. But before John Negroponte went to Iraq as our ambassador for a short time, there were not, we did not see death squads and we were not seeing bodies showing up. And I came on this program. You can go back and listen to the archives over at our, White Rose Society or at our website. And I came on and I said, when John Negroponte went into South America, immediately thereafter, death squads started appearing, and you started finding people with their hands tied behind their back and a bullet in their head.
That's
in,
right.
5, 10, 15 of them. And he acquired the nickname Death Squad John. And now he's gone over to be, or he's going over to be our ambassador to Iraq. And I predict within a few weeks we're going to start seeing death squads and you're going to start seeing bodies show up. And sure enough, it happened. I don't know if it had anything to do with John Negroponte. I don't know if I was being prescient or if it was just a coincidence, or if I was simply calling it the way it is. I don't know. I can't. That's a very, very harsh and severe charge to make against somebody. But you're asserting that the CIA is running it. I think at this point the CIA doesn't have to. I think all they have to do is get out of the way and let old blood feuds play themselves out. And you're going to see this kind of tragedy. And that's what we think we can prevent. We think that we can insert ourselves between people who have been fighting and killing each other for 1,400 years and stop them. And it's going to take a force much more powerful than us. It took Saddam Hussein, with an army of 1 million people and 30 years of a reign of terror and knowing it. I mean, he climbed from the bottom up to the top in that tribal structure, knowing it from the inside out, knowing all the subtleties, knowing all the nuance, knowing all that. That's what it took to put that under control. We have, by going in and tipping that thing over, George Bush really and truly opened the gates of hell. There's just no other way to describe it. It's an utter and absolute disaster. John in Gilbert, Arizona, welcome to the program. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Like always, I enjoy your show, and I call you my professor.
Well, thank you. What's up, John?
Tom, my question to you is, living in the state of Arizona, when you guys are talking about we need to call our senator for the impeachment process, I feel stuck because I got worthless McCain and Kyle.
Well, I would call them anyway. And who's your member? Those are your two senators. Do you know who your member of the House of Representatives is?
No, I don't. That's what I need to find out. Huh?
There you do. So call 866-220-0044, the toll-free number for Congress, and just give me your zip code and say, I'm not sure who my member of Congress is. Most Americans don't know who their member of Congress is. And just say, I'm not sure who my member of Congress is. Please tell me. They will tell you. And then say, will you please connect me to that person and start calling them every week? Because impeachment has to start in the House of Representatives.
Now, let me ask you this. Even if those people are Republicans, I mean, they still got to fulfill the American people, right?
That's right. Even if they're Republicans, you should call them. In fact, I would say, you're welcome, I would say even more so if they're Republicans, you should call them. The other group that you can call are the people who are the chair members, chairmen, chairwomen, whatever it may be, of committees. Pat Leahy, I believe, is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for example. In the House, I believe it's John Conyers. And call the committee heads because they represent more than just their state or their district. They represent the entire United States as a committee head. And point that out to them. Say, hey, I live in Arizona. You're the senator from whatever, Vermont. But I'm calling you because you're the head of this particular committee or you're on this particular committee. And therefore, I think that you have a national responsibility, not just a local responsibility. And I'd like you to know my opinion. And they will take that. They will listen to that. Sandra in Berkeley, California. Hey, Sandra.
Hi. I've called your show before. Keep doing what you're doing, Tom. You're doing
Thanks,
a great
Sandra.
Job. I called a couple of years ago, and it was really funny because I'm one of those people. It's not like I see the future. I'm not trying to say I'm psychic, but I see mathematical possibilities somehow. And I don't know. I've always done this. And a few years ago, I started seeing what was going on, and I've been calling people, doing things, feeling so frustrated, feeling angry. And I think George Bush wants to start a war in Iran and a nuclear war. And
oh, there's no doubt about it. He's already planning it. He is already planning.
I said 2 years ago on your show, and you kind of said, oh, no, I don't think that's going to happen because I think it's going to happen. But
well, two years ago, I might have been skeptical about it. I am quite certain right now that unless something is done to stop him, that George W. Bush is going to provoke Iran in such a way that he will have a justification. Exactly. He will have a justification to attack and call it retaliation.
He's not going to attack them. This is what I called all the senators and told them. He's not going to attack them. He's going to say he retaliated for something that they did, but he's going to retaliate before he tells anyone. So he's going to back us into this war, and then it's going to be like this thing when I saw Condoleezza Rice on TV right after they started the war in Iraq, and I believe she was at a meeting in Iraq, and she basically looked at the camera and said, I'm sorry I don't like this, but it's too late now. And she got this funny little smile on her face, like a little kid, like, you may not like where we are. If we leave, it's going to be a big catastrophe. So they knew that then, and they knew exactly what they were doing. They backed us into the war in Iraq, and now they're going to back us into the one in Iran. And it's going to be the end of the world. Do not understand what is going on right now.
Yeah, well, what's going on is a fundamental realignment of power and wealth all around the world, Sandra. And I don't think it's going to be the end of the world as we know it, but I think it's going to be a very, very difficult and painful time for a lot of people, including us. And when we need to do everything we can to stop it. Sandra, I have to move along. Thank you for the call, though. I appreciate it. Susan in Seattle. Hey, Susan.
Hey there. I wanted to go back to the healthcare
topic.
I'm for the one-payer system. I think moving it all into Medicare makes a lot of sense. However, we are a capitalist country, and I want to know what ideas you might have to deal with what's going to happen to these insurance companies.
Let them go out of business.
That's just it. I mean,
it's just that simple.
I don't think we're going to be able to sell this if we don't do something to.
What happened to the buggy whip manufacturers when Henry Ford came along?
Well, but that was a capitalist idea versus a capitalist idea. That's not quite the same. Do you know what I mean?
I do, but it's. What happened to the people who were selling old age insurance when Social Security came along? I mean, it's just, things happen. Markets change. Things happen. I put them out of business. We have no reason, in my opinion, to have, maybe some small, there's some very wealthy people are going to want it. In a lot of countries around the world, in Germany and Canada, you can buy health insurance for specific things. If you want to leapfrog the system or whatever, very wealthy people can get into it. There'll still be a market. But it'll be much, much smaller. These companies are leeches on the back of American society. Thank you for the call, Sandra. 45 minutes past the hour.
I want the America my daddy used to know. The right was right and not political code. Where leaders in D.C. respected you and me, the America my daddy taught to me.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interests. Marie in Columbus, Ohio, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, Marie. How are you today?
I'm doing fairly well. Look, I want to talk about Dinesh D'Souza, and I got
my blood pressure went up when you were debating him. Anyway, look, Dinesh D'Souza would not be in this country if it wasn't for the Immigration Act of 1965. He came to this country in 1977. And prior to 65, from what I understand, only Europeans were allowed to immigrate to America. And so D'Souza benefited from left progressive ideas.
From a liberal. Yeah.
And also, he wrote that despicable book called The End of Racism, which was on the heels of Charles Murray's The Bell Curve.
Yes.
Both came out of the American Enterprise Institute. Okay. And I saw him years ago on Black Entertainment Television when Black Entertainment Television had some good aspects to it. Now it's owned by Viacom, and they have totally took off all the political shows. But he was interviewed by a host named Bev Smith. And Bev Smith asked him at that time, well, do you ever associate with black people? Because she was, you know, wonder where he got these ideas about, you know, because the book is awful. And
right.
he was basically promoting
the bell curve concepts.
He never associates with them. He does not socialize with them at all.
Yeah.
That was his answer. So he is dishonest. He's being used, and yet he probably benefited from affirmative action.
Yeah, and at the same time, Marie, the other thing that we all need to notice, and I think notice very, very, very clearly, is that he's in the New York Times. He was in the New York Times last week. The Wall Street Journal mentioned him. The national media is picking this guy up big time because he's got some big money behind him. He's got some serious, solid folks promoting what he's doing on the conservative side, and this is the, you know, he's going to be the next Ann Coulter, only not as much of a cartoon character.
Oh, and by the way, he is listed on Wikipedia as one of Ann Coulter's former boyfriends.
Oh my.
So enough said.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Marie, thank you very much for the call. Just the idea,
right.
I met Ann Coulter once. I have never met a woman with such a large Adam's apple. Anyhow, Alex in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Alex. Alex is...
Hey, how you doing?
Whoop, I'm sorry, Alex. I'd already pushed the button when you were halfway into the sentence. Bob in Eureka, California. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
Oh, man, that D'Souza guy. I watched him on Colbert the other night and went back and watched... it was on Crooks and Liars, and I went back and they had a link to Stewart eviscerating Ramesh Padanaru.
Mm-hmm.
And those two guys in particular, but I think this is true of all the right-wing authors, Bernard Goldberg and Jonah Goldberg, for that matter. I wanted to ask you, as while I was waiting, I thought of a perfect term for what you are, is you're kind of a sublinguist. You're what's behind and underneath the tongue. And I wonder if they are actually believe in that worldview.
Yes, they do.
Or they're just dissembling.
No. There's an internal coherence there that they couldn't maintain if they didn't really believe it. And the question, in fact, it's interesting, this morning I was talking with my co-host on the morning program that I do for KPOJ, Heidi Tauber, and about this very issue. And I said, you know, what's interesting to me, my question, the big question in my mind is, are people born with that conservative worldview, that conservative assumption that humans are evil and that everything that happened before civilization was terrible, and, you know, the Thomas Hobbes notion that life was short and brutish and whatever, or are they acculturated to it? Do they learn it as a consequence of growing up? What causes that conservative, what I think is frankly a pathological worldview, in the sense that it harms the world?
Well, I think some of it is acclimatized. Like much as yourself, where you worked for Goldwater in '64, I grew up in a relatively conservative household. My father was a doctor, I had a Nixon bumper sticker on my car on my bicycle in 1960.
Yeah.
And yet today I got out of Vietnam as a conscientious objector, one of the last of the war. I was actually got the discharge.
And I'm pretty much, politically, I'm really not a liberal. I'm a wobbly.
Yeah. You mean, as in the international workers of the world?
Well, not...
The socialist wobblies? Or semi-socialist wobblies?
Well, yeah, semi-socialist. I mean, I'm a businessman too, so you know, I have a business. So it's not like I think that the workers should get everything and I should get nothing.
Yeah, but there should be a balance of power. I mean, that was the main point of the wobblies, and frankly, of much of the early socialist movement. Although you know, some of it was also pretty badly contaminated by Marx. Bob, I got to run. Thanks a lot for the call. We have to wrap up the hour. And we will be back tomorrow, however. We will continue this conversation and more. In fact, tomorrow I'll be debating conservative Stephen Gabriel. He says, a Canadian court has decided a child can have three parents. This is terrible. And in our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Marty Essen is here. He's going to talk about what we have to do to save unpopular animals like venomous snakes and vampire bats and why our survival might depend on that and more, and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. And don't forget, activism and democracy begin with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.